Small Town Podcast is made possible by generous support from the Georgia Municipal Association. GMA supports Georgia cities. Small Town Podcast is supported by Consolidated Pipe and Supply Company. Consolidated Pipe and Supply Company is a full-line supplier of products for the water, wastewater, and natural gas industries, and they serve utilities and public works departments in cities, large and small, every day. As a family-owned company with a legacy that began in 1960, let Consolidated Pipe and Supply Company show you that they are dedicated to service.
I hereby call this episode to order.
Hey, small towners, it's Mayor Matt Seal, and thanks for joining me for another episode of Small Town Podcast. So if you've been listening to Small Town Podcast for a while, you know that every once in a while, I take time to explore an issue that affects local government as a whole, instead of exploring a specific small town. So today, we're going to discuss the impacts of the pandemic on local government revenue. This pandemic, and really any economic recession, has far-reaching effects that eventually impact the local government that people expect to receive services from. We'll start out on Zoom and then head to Atlanta to talk with some friends at the Georgia Municipal Association. Come go with me. Growing up in coastal Georgia, I only thought I lived in a small town. As soon as I graduated high school, I moved to the big city of Atlanta for college and to start my life. My life is a journey, and I ended up in Ocilla, Georgia. Population 3,400. We've got two traffic lights here. We're not looking to get a third anytime soon. Some years later, the people of Ocilla made me their mayor. Man, I love living in a small town. Other folks do too. This is the Small Town Podcast, and I'm your host, Mayor Matt Seal of the great city of Ocilla, Georgia. Small Town Podcast is sponsored by the Douglas Coffee County Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development Authority. Our nation is going through an incredible transition right now. There's a mass migration to small towns and rural communities. People are seeking out vibrant communities with great entertainment, recreational opportunities, low cost of living, and strong local economies. If that sounds like something you would like to find, then I invite you to discover the city of Douglas and Coffee County, Georgia. Visit coffeegachamber.com to find out why the Douglas Coffee County community is a great place to visit and an even better place to call home. You may have heard of the Pew Charitable Trust. What you may not know is that they have a research arm that, among other things, looks at ways that government can be better by studying the impacts of the way that governments at all levels operate and provide services. This includes how they are able to fund those operations and provide those services. Pew recently released a study entitled Local Tax Limitations Can Hamper Fiscal Stability of Cities and Counties, and it describes how the restrictions that states put on local governments can put a damper on the economic recovery for those local governments. Pew reached out to me here at Small Town Podcast about having this discussion on the podcast, which I was glad to do. I was able to have a conversation with the author of the report, Alexandria Zhang. She lives in Washington, D.C., so we met over Zoom. We started by getting a summary and the background of the overall issues surrounding revenue for local governments.
I think maybe giving a little bit of background on why we took on this project would be helpful to start. So we, at the beginning of last year, started to see the impact of the pandemic on local governments unfold slowly but significantly. And, you know, we saw that not only was the pandemic in terms of the economic shutdowns impacting a number of local revenue sources very dramatically, especially those tied to tourism and hospitality, but, you know, local governments were also called on to basically be at the front lines of the pandemic response. And that led to, of course, rising costs for local officials as well. And, you know, we saw pressures from both these sides, but also expected states that will eventually also be hurting from the pandemic kind of pass down that pain to local governments by reducing state aid. So what we wanted to look into was the flexibility that local governments have to respond and deal with this type of crisis, and especially how state policies impact that flexibility. And so that led us down the path of looking specifically at local taxation, because, of course, the revenue that local governments bring in determines how prepared they are to, you know, not only provide for their residents in the long term, but also respond to, you know, this type of fiscal crisis. And so the report, you know, outlines some of the common challenges that local governments face across the country, and also speaks directly to state lawmakers and gives them a few recommendations they can consider for how to mitigate some of those challenges for their local government.
It sounds like you, obviously you started looking at it because the pandemic affected so many different aspects of government. Obviously, revenue and finance is a huge part of how we run things. But was there something, I guess, that catalyzed your interest in this? Was there, did people bring something to you saying, hey, here's this thing that's happening to us, or it's happened in previous, maybe the recession of 08-09 would be an example of where revenue fell precipitously. And then it, when it came back in the commercial sector, it didn't come back in the public sector quite as much. So I guess what was it that kind of made you look a little more deeply into this topic?
Yeah, I think part of it is driven by the fact that my team at Pew broadly looks at how states can support the fiscal health of their local governments. And most of our work up until now has been around states just monitoring the local fiscal conditions and kind of seeing, you know, what technical assistance they can provide, resources they can provide. This was an offshoot of that also allowed us to look more deeply into how local finances work, which I think we've tried to branch out into for a little bit, but this gave us the chance to do just that. And I'm trying to think if there were any other huge motivations. I think it really was just seeing a lot of the reporting on the pandemic and how, you know, I think states got a lot of the attention in terms of, you know, the fact that they do finance big ticket items like Medicaid and higher education. But I think this pandemic really drew out how local governments really provide a lot of the backbone of the services that we expect from day to day.
So did this compare, because there were some references to previous economic recessions, you know, you have a downturn, so I guess how, if there is a comparison between, like I said, the previous recession, 2008, 2009, and the recovery after that, obviously this was very different in so many different ways. So, but I'm sure there's some comparisons and contrasting you can do. That was kind of the one where you've already seen the recovery all the way through. So you kind of had the end state in mind as you're making the comments about how we can do things better while we're in the current state of this one. So make comments about that and kind of what you discovered by looking at the last complete cycle, if I can call it that.
Yeah, absolutely. The Great Recession did unfold very differently from this particular crisis. I think what we found interesting about the comparison is that the Great Recession was really, you know, a housing market crisis, right? And so that significantly hit property taxes, which is huge for local governments because that's still by far the biggest tax source for most local governments in the U.S., and so, you know, a lot of local governments felt the pain in that way. And some of that also was kind of a lagged response to the Great Recession, right? A lot of that ended up unfolding or continuing to unfold even a couple of years after the recession, you know, officially ended. This time around, I think there was some expectation that property taxes might be impacted, but we haven't seen much of that yet. That, you know, I don't think anyone expected the housing market to actually blow up and grow in many areas.
Right.
So I think it was the opposite effect of, you know, property taxes ended up being rather stable, whereas, you know, sales taxes, for example, were immediately hit. And so I think there are a lot of differences, but I think we have provided some examples in the report of how, you know, looking over the long term, these tax limits create these challenges that get worse over, you know, after multiple business cycles, right? So after one recession, a local government is trying to recover, and may not fully recover before the next crisis hits. And that is true for some communities in Michigan that we talk about. There's actual data showing that several communities in that state have not seen property tax revenue recover to Great Recession levels, even though the real estate market had already bounced back, you know, a few years later. So that, of course, makes them even less prepared for the next recession.
And that was partly because of some of the caps that you mentioned?
Yeah, so Michigan is a bit of a unique flower in that they have the local governments there face three different property tax limits. You know, they're generally three types. There's, you know, limits on assessed value, limits on the total revenue locals can collect, as well as limits on the tax rate. So they face all three. And then there are two that specifically kind of work together to keep revenue depressed after it declines during a recession, and has, at least after the Great Recession, because recovery was so slow for both state and local governments, has really prevented some of these localities in Michigan from getting back to where they were before the Great Recession.
Well, and it seems like it's because you've got caps on the way up to limit the increases, but there's no floor or stairs where it says, okay, even if it drops this much, we're only going to drop your taxes this much. There's a fairness issue there. And I'm sure that no politician wants to say, hey, while everyone's down and out, we're also going to make sure that they don't get too much tax relief. And that's not politically palatable, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, there's an argument for it being somewhat countercyclical in that, you know, like taxpayers during recession have less ability to pay, right? And so it, like you said, it's hard to set that floor, but at the same time, the state policy should at least allow local revenue to recover, right, as the economy recovers. So, you know, whatever services that you had to cut during the recession to balance budgets and, you know, weather that crisis, you can restore those cuts.
And that actually kind of leaves me, I was going to make sure that you described your ratchet down effect. We kind of segued into it a little bit, but go ahead and describe that, because you talked about it as a concept and then you gave examples. I think it was five states total that you profiled in the article, and most, if not all of them, had some kind of consequence of that ratchet down effect. So go ahead and describe that for us and how that negatively impacts local government's ability to continue to provide services in these conditions.
Yeah, the ratchet down effect is a pretty interesting and somewhat unique scenario. It's a bit of an outlier. It's not necessarily a common challenge for a lot of local governments in the country, but for those that do experience it, it leads to some serious consequences. So especially local governments in Michigan, like I just mentioned, as well as governments in Colorado, face these limits where, you know, instead of allowing revenue to recover when it drops during recession because of various economic reasons, that decline in revenue actually pulls down the revenue cap, so that it continues to depress revenue in subsequent years, even as the economy bounces back. And so, of course, you can think of that as kind of an artificially low level, right, for revenue to grow in the subsequent years. And so over, you know, the long term and multiple business cycles, you can imagine these tax limits continuously eroding the local tax base over time, right? Especially if revenue doesn't have a chance to recover before the next crisis hits.
You mentioned at least, and I think it was one, I know at least one, but maybe even two of the examples where there was kind of a one-size-fits-all policy. And then when it went into place, you had a disproportionate effect between metropolitan areas and rural areas, for mm-hmm. example. And mm-hmm. since this is a small town podcast, we like to look out for the small towns, rural areas. So talk to that a little bit. And I'd love to ask if there's, because you have some recommendations about flexibility in the article that I definitely want us to get to. But is there maybe a better way, a recommendation for that specifically? And I guess probably the answer is greater flexibility. Don't make a one-size-fits-all policy. But if it's something more than that, speak to potential solutions to keep those disparities from happening.
Yeah, I really like those examples because they really do show, like you said, these tax limits at the state level are a one-size-fits-all approach for localities that are so different in so many ways in terms of what services they offer to the residents, how they're structured, who lives in those communities. And so the one example, one of the examples we give is in Wisconsin, there's a property tax limit that only allows growth in property tax revenue at the rate of new construction. So no other allowable growth. So obviously, you know, this is going to advantage faster growing areas and disadvantage slower growing areas. And actually the Wisconsin Policy Forum did some deeper analysis and found that between, I want to say 2008 and 2017, 60% of cities and villages in Wisconsin saw an average rate of growth of new construction of less than 1%. And so, you know, if you compare that to the inflation rate over those years, that was less than the inflation rate.
Out of curiosity, what was the, I guess, because if it is possible, and I've seen places where it happens, if you control new construction and you keep new homes from being built, it actually kind of increases demand if you've got a nice place to live, a nice school district, something like that. So it seemed odd to me that you would base it on that and not on assessments at all. So you can have a setup where you're capped on how your taxes, your property taxes at least, can go up, even if your demand, since your supply is staying the same, your demand may be going up because of some of the amenities or school system or job, you know, employment center, whatever. If you know, since you researched it, what was the, I guess, the motivating factor behind basing that on new construction as opposed to any other metric?
Yeah, it's interesting. Wisconsin, we actually know some of the motivation because it can really vary, you know, when it comes to these tax limits. In the mid-2000s, I guess, right before the Great Recession, the entire state went through a boom. So economic growth was really, really high. And so lawmakers saw this as a solution to reduce taxpayer burden, right? But, you know, unfortunate for them, the Great Recession hit and slowed down growth, you know, significantly in many of these areas. And that growth really hasn't come back up in some areas either. And so it's really hamstringed a lot of localities. And I think that is also indicative of the fact that, you know, tax limits rarely change, if at all, which is also, it doesn't make as much sense to, you know, keep these tax limits constant when economic conditions do not stay the same, you know. And so that's one way that under these tax limits, local officials, you know, just can't respond to, you know, the changing times and, you know, how the economy goes up and down.
Right. So what were the, I guess I'll go back to the question because I think I interrupted you before you got to get into this. Recommendations other than just general more flexibility as far as, you know, these one size fits all policies. And we see them in our state sometimes too. You know, I'm sure every state, no legislator introduces a bill with bad intentions, most of them anyway. But sometimes there are some negative consequences. The example you just gave, it was because things were booming at the time. And so legislation was put in place that was certainly not a benefit when that boom kind of slowed down or even turned into a bust. What are some ways to kind of keep from doing that, I guess?
Yeah, so I guess apart from flexibility, which I'm also having to go over, you know, that those explicit recommendations that we have in the brief. But I mean, I think generally, you know, going back to some of the broader research our team does, we encourage states to monitor local fiscal conditions in their state. You know, it comes down to the fact that when a local government fails, not only do residents pay the price, you know, states also have to take on a lot of that burden as well. And so when it comes to the examples in Wisconsin, I think it would make sense to, you know, periodically evaluate some of these tax limits, right? And just understand how they're impacting local governments, especially if there are these economic disparities in the state, and kind of assess, you know, are these hurting local governments more than they're actually helping, you know, the residents in these communities. But I think overall, our report really emphasizes that, you know, because local communities are so different, we really encourage state lawmakers to think about how to give local leaders more flexibility to, you know, make the right choices for their communities, because state lawmakers, you know, aren't on the ground.
Right. One layer away. What, exactly. Let's go through, since you, I mean, you made some pretty specific or at least, you know, categorical recommendations about that. So let's go through those that you actually put in the article about what state governments can do to allow for that flexibility. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll run through. So we have three recommendations. I'll run through them briefly, and then I'm happy to go back and, you know, give some examples. But the first one is simply to temporarily lift some tax limits during a fiscal crisis like this pandemic, or, you know, during a natural disaster, when it makes sense to give local governments more tools to address it, but also to get through it and get out on the other side. The second recommendation is to make sure that tax limits are not preventing revenue from recovering fully after a recession. So we know this has certainly been some of the consequences in Colorado and Michigan, but, you know, we haven't done a comprehensive 50-state scan of all the challenges that, you know, local governments face when it comes to these limits. So certainly ensuring that that doesn't happen will encourage and support local fiscal stability down the road. And then last but not least, we offer some longer-term solutions outside of changing tax limits. So, you know, one is encouraging service sharing among local jurisdictions. I think we haven't done a deep dive into service sharing specifically, but we do think that the state can play a pretty big role in facilitating that, you know, providing some resources to get that going, especially if it's smaller governments trying to come together and, you know, it's a bit harder for them because they have limited resources. Another, which is one of my favorites because I'm an economist, is for states to continuously update their sales tax base so that it captures current economic activity. And, you know, one good example of that is before the pandemic, the majority of states already were taxing a lot of online retail. And so that was a huge boon for states as well as for the local governments that levy a sales tax and use the state sales tax base. And so, you know, this isn't updating the sales tax base. It's not a one-time action, right? You have to continually kind of assess, you know, what is the current economy? What's your local state economy like? And make sure that you're really capturing that economic activity.
I'm curious, there was one, the comparison, and I'm familiar with this, and you may want to just kind of give a quick definition of Dillon rule and home rule for our listening audience. But I was curious between the two, since there are states that have both, and then even among those, you even pointed out in the article, there's varying degrees with which it's enforced, and there's exceptions to, say, Dillon rule or things like that. How maybe, if we call them two different groups, there's states that are under Dillon rule, states that are under home rule. Did some do better than others in previous recessions, or are you seeing evidence that some do better than others now? And again, like I said, you might want to start with a quick definition of Dillon rule and home rule for us.
Yeah, Dillon rule and home rule are essentially the two categorizations of how states delegate authority to local governments. And so under Dillon's rule, for the most part, local governments have less latitude when it comes to determining anything from governing structure to local taxes, whereas home rule status does give local leaders more freedom around these local decisions. You know, we do say a caveat is it's not black and white. So there are some Dillon's rule places that do enjoy some freedom and home rule localities that do not, especially around local taxation. That is actually still the area of decision making.
Why is it that money is different than every other category? Is it fair to classify Dillon rule as the state has to explicitly give the local government the power, and home rule, it's almost the exact opposite? If they didn't say you couldn't do it, you probably could at least try as far as how you govern. Is that a fair way to summarize?
I think so. Yes. So for the most part, under Dillon's rule, anything that's not explicitly, any authority that's not explicitly granted, you have to go to the legislature and ask.
You don't have
for that. Whereas home rule, yeah, you can, you know, read between the lines. But
So did, were there,
Yeah,
good. I was going to ask if there were states that as a category, if one did better than another, I mean, I'm sure there's advantages, disadvantages. I prefer the home rule, but maybe that's because I'm in a home rule state and I just can't imagine having to go to the legislature for every little thing.
Yeah, sure. It's a good question. And I wish, you know, maybe in the future we could dive into that a bit more. But so I can't really say if there is definitive evidence that, you know, home rule lessens the challenges that local governments have when it comes to, you know, state preemption. I think one example is that the local governments in Colorado, when under home rule status, they're able to set their own sales tax bases, right? And so they have some control over their destiny, you know, they, which is, you know, pretty big. But at the same time, they, and I think it certainly, again, it depends on, so these are, you know, broad definitions of don't do a home rule.
Sure.
Of course, this varies from state to state, as does everything. And so, you know, for example, in Colorado, Tabor, which is, you know, one of the kind of strictest constitutional amendments that have to do with, you know, tax limits at both the state and local level, that I believe still applies to home rule municipalities. But, you know, what Colorado local governments have been able to do, which is interesting and kind of speaks to the fact that voters do understand some of these challenges, is that they've been, many localities have at least temporarily been able to override some of these tax limits, you know, explaining we need this revenue to maintain parks and all those good things.
It sounds like you just started to give examples. I was going to ask you if you've already seen some examples of essentially states taking your recommendation, or maybe they were more likely to do it even in previous recessions. So, or do you have some, I guess, maybe I'll call them case studies of, you've got these three main recommendations and obviously a lot of different sub things that could go under each of those three categories. But are you seeing examples where these are tried and it does have that positive impact that you would predict?
Yeah, I guess going back to Colorado, this, you know, ratchet of down effect previously happened to state revenue as well, because it's under a similar limit as local revenue. And so what the legislature did in 2005 was put forth a referendum, which passed, that changed this tax limit, you know, very simply to make it so that this ratchet down effect did not happen. And specifically, you know, that the revenue cap didn't depend on previous year spending levels, right, which drops during a recession and consequently pulls down that cap every time a recession happens. And so, you know, they made this fairly simple tweak that has allowed them to get rid of that unintended consequence. Another example that we like to highlight is in Pennsylvania, the state actually does have a, we'll call a local monitoring program that helps distressed communities through a fiscal crisis through their Act 47 program. And under that program, local governments are able to go beyond the state's tax limits in order to balance the budget for the next year and upcoming years. And so, you know, that's an example of temporarily exempting, you know, localities from the limits. Of course, you don't want to wait until a local government is already in fiscal distress. Ideally, you know, you do it preemptively. So in sum, I would say, you know, what our Pew team has really tried to highlight is that local governments really keep a community running and provide, you know, the basic services you don't really think about it, you know, you take for granted until they break down.
Yeah.
And so this pandemic really highlighted that local governments need the tools to not only address short-term challenges, but also longer-term challenges, and really make sure they're resilient in the long term. And so these tax limits are one way that states create challenges that local governments have to deal with. And so in response, you know, state lawmakers can consider ways to give local leaders more flexibility for the sake of local communities.
Yeah. All right. Well, Alexandria Zhang, thanks so much for writing this, for looking into this very critical issue for how we operate local governments. And thanks for joining us on Small Town Podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mayor Matt, for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Irwinomics is the producer of Small Town Podcast. We also handle digital production and marketing for small businesses that help small towns survive and thrive. In today's global and very digital world, your digital presence is just as important as your physical presence, if not more so. Irwinomics helps clients with all aspects of digital communications, from website creation and maintenance, social media management, email lists and newsletters, digital content creation, including audio and video production, and making sure that all of these things are working together to build your business beyond the city limits and county lines, so you can focus on keeping your small town community strong and vibrant. For more information and to see how Irwinomics can help guide you in growing your business, go to Irwinomics.com or contact us through Small Town Podcast. That's IRWINOMICS.com. Irwinomics, helping small town business thrive. After talking with Alexandria about her findings, I thought it would be appropriate to discuss this issue with some folks in my own home state of Georgia about how things are, and maybe how they should be, for the local governments in Georgia. We first spoke with someone you'll likely remember if you've listened to previous episodes where we discussed local government issues.
Hello, I'm Larry Hansen, the Executive Director of the Georgia Municipal Association, and proud to serve and work for all 537 cities in Georgia. And it's great today to be with you, Mayor Seale. Looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, always. We talk about how GMA works on behalf of cities. A lot of people don't realize all the different inner workings, obviously service providing, but advocacy. And so our topic today in relation to the article that I know you've read, and we're going to talk about some revenue and finance thing. But even before that, and this can be broader than... because you and I talk about this, we have to talk about this in GMA circles all the time, the importance of local control and home rule. And there was even a description about the difference between home rule and Dillon rule in that article. So I'm thankful that Georgia is under a home rule structure. I'm sure you are too. But just talk about the importance. And I'll even say this. I didn't realize until I became a mayor, got involved with GMA, and started going to the Capitol, the tremendous amount of legislative either proposals and sometimes action that has some kind of impact on cities and counties, just local governments in general. And so the importance cannot be overstated, I don't think. But yeah, just speak to that and what you deal with.
Absolutely true. And those are valid points. And we are certainly grateful Georgia is a home rule state and it's practiced the majority of the time. One senator last year made a comment that I found rather funny, but also very true. But he said, we're for home rule, except when we're not.
That's right.
But, you know, home rule is important because you see the nation, each state, we don't have a statewide economy. We have individual economies, and those that are closest to the action, those that are in those communities and working with people and businesses and corporations and attending church and Little League baseball games and interacting with people in restaurants, those are the ones that are best suited to make those decisions about how best to fund local government services and what kind of track structure is best for the citizens of that community.
So I guess with regard to the article, what were some of the key, takeaways or things that kind of jumped out at you as either, wow, I'm glad that whatever that state was doing, it doesn't happen in Georgia, or something that maybe was something you desire more in Georgia?
Well, you know, you make a good point. In reading the article, I think the first thing we always have to do is look at the upside and the positive of it. And Georgia does treat its local governments well as compared to some other states that have really been very restrictive on what local governments can do and taken away a lot of their local control to make decisions. So we should be appreciative that Georgia generally has been a good steward of local control and gives flexibility to local governments. But with that said, we believe more flexibility would be a good thing. And it's not necessarily more taxes. It's having more autonomy to determine what's in the best interest of your own city or your own community.
Yeah, and that's actually, there's even been some recent legislation that has helped level the playing field. Now, some of it may look at, like internet sales tax, some of those things, as a new tax, but it's really not. It's just where we're saying, okay, we want to make sure this is the same for a downtown business in a city of any size in Georgia as it is for an online retailer. And so yeah, it's not about new taxes, like I say.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think there's two key points that are sometimes overlooked or misunderstood, and that is these taxes were always required to be paid. They weren't required to be collected.
Yeah.
And so the law corrected that. Yeah. Now they're required to be collected. And secondly, it impacts and harms local businesses. If I can go into a local brick and mortar store and I can take pictures of their products and their sale prices and I can go home and order that from an online retailer, I start off 7% ahead. And yet I'm taking sales out of my brick and mortar businesses who are not only buying business licenses and paying taxes, but they're investing in the community. They're sponsoring little league baseball teams or sponsoring school events and sports. And how can they do that when they're constantly now, we're in an environment where they were having sales taken away? So it levelizes and it treats brick and mortar businesses fair in local communities. And the online retailers are now required to collect and remit those sales taxes as they have been all along, but we're not doing.
Right, right. You mentioned, you actually alluded to this earlier in this conversation, this kind of one size fits mm-hmm. all concept. And certainly with revenue flexibility or revenue in general, we see things that get put in place maybe with one specific city or county mm-hmm. in Georgia in mind, and there's 537 cities and 159 counties. So you take that one and you make it the same for all, and there ends up being some, I guess, negative consequences. And there was even the example in the article about, I think it was Colorado, where the property tax limitations or some restrictions on it negatively impacting some rural areas. And so that was near and dear to my heart as a small town mayor from rural South Georgia. So I guess, what can we do different about that? How do we, because I understand the concepts and the protections. And I think when people start put forward a legislative proposal, it's with good intentions. It's to, you know, correct something, make something better. But how do we better protect against some of those consequences across the state?
Yeah, well, I give the benefit of the doubt that all legislation is well intended.
Sure.
But sometimes it's dropped in order to address one situation. And we don't have a one size fits all economy in Georgia. And let's say that you're in a large metro area and your property values are rising substantially, and therefore someone might want to cap those values because those taxes become a challenge to people. But yet other areas of the state, property values are not rising
right.
in that same, if at all. And property taxes may be their major source of revenue because they're not a sales tax-based economy or other things. And therefore, if that restriction applies uniformly, as in the case of sales tax cap or freezes, well, then that rural area that you're describing is really harmed by a piece of legislation that was intended to solve a problem in a major urban area that's really seeing dynamic growth in property values, but it affects everyone. And we find that's often the kind of legislation we have to work against, that it has unintended consequences. It may be well-intended, but the unintended consequences outweigh the consequences of solving one problem and creating 200 in the process.
Yeah.
So I believe our cities need more flexibility, not necessarily more taxes. So for instance, we talk about Georgia's economy. You've got areas of the state that have a very much an agricultural-based economy, and others may have a retail-based economy. Your larger cities do. And some are major employment centers and have a population that's there during the day
right.
and leaves suburban areas in the evening. So our economies are not all the same. But we know that well over 100 cities would benefit from municipal option sales tax. Well, what is bad about having an extra penny of sales tax if you're required to roll that back and reduce property taxes, and yet citizens in that community have to vote and pass that referendum so they get to practice self-governance and self-control? They decide what is in their best interest as a taxpayer by how they vote on a municipal sales tax option. We think that Georgia City should have that right to have that conversation and have that referendum, and certainly expect that there's a benefit to taxpayers too in those communities where it makes sense because they pay less property taxes. So that's a good example of giving cities more flexibility and letting those city leaders and mayors and council members listen to their own citizens, have a referendum, and decide what's in their best interest based on their local economy.
One of the things in going back to the actual article we're kind of focusing in on for this conversation, we have thoughts about, because the focus seemed to be on caps, that there's a limiting factor that the states put on local governments, cities and counties, and various states. So that just seemed to have, and the article presented it quite well, if you put a cap on something, you're kind of handcuffing your local government, but you're not not able to do that on the services side, or maybe you have to on that. So what were your thoughts on that?
Well, you're right. The millage rate caps do present a problem and a challenge because really there are two things that can occur. Number one, it limits a local government's ability to raise the revenue necessary to provide the services that people want. And yet, number two, it puts a government in a difficult position. So if you limit taxes, if you say your millage rate cannot be higher than this, and therefore that revenue source won't grow when you hit that mark, but yet there's no relationship between that and service delivery. A local government can't say, we're only going to accept then the first 400 911 calls, or we're only going to respond to the first 75 fires.
Right, right.
And so you see, there has to be a relationship between the revenue and the expenditures, the services that citizens need and demand. Because frankly, you can't be competitive in economic development unless you have a high-quality fire department with a good ISO rating and good response times. And if your revenues begin to decline or you have caps, then you have to make cuts. And public safety uniformly across this state is the highest expenditure of local governments,
sure.
as it should
oh,
be.
Yeah. Yeah.
As
and,
it should
and
be.
I know everybody listening just thought it was ridiculous, the suggestion that you have a cap on the number of 911 calls.
That's right.
Or fire responses.
That's exactly right.
But here we are capping the other side of that.
What it forces you to do then is raise other revenues.
Right.
So it creates different winners and losers. The cost of government is the cost of government.
Well, Larry Hansen, as always, very insightful. So thanks for talking with us.
All right. Well, thanks. It's always good to be with you. And appreciate what you're doing with our cities around the state. It's a great opportunity to share a message. And you have a great listening audience. So it's good to be here today.
Well, thanks. And thanks for what you do for those cities all around the state. Mm-hmm.
All right.
The Georgia Municipal Association has an entire government relations team who work on behalf of Georgia cities at the Georgia State Capitol. We actually sat down with them and got to know each member of the team in a previous season. Well, there's a new member of the team, and he deals with revenue and finance issues that directly affect Georgia cities. I asked him to introduce himself and give us a little background before we began our conversation.
My name is Ryan Bowersox, and I'm a member of the Government Relations Team at the Georgia Municipal Association, GMA. I've been here for a little less than a year now. I moved to Georgia in about 2000 after moving around a good bit as a kid. Went to high school here up in Johns Creek, went to University of Georgia for getting my JD at Wake Forest. My only time leaving the state for a little while to go to North Carolina. And coming back, I was always kind of interested in politics. I had had a few experiences down at the Capitol and ended up landing a job at the Senate Research Office, a nonpartisan support office for all the senators and lieutenant governor. And when I was there, we divided up our office into different committees at the Senate level. And I worked for the Finance Committee. I worked for the Economic Development and Tourism Committee and the Committee on Banking and spent a little over 3 years there. Loved it, loved being down at the Capitol, working behind the scenes a little bit and working in those policy areas, and was fortunate enough to have GMA reach out and have an interest in me joining their government relations team. And while on the team, I cover revenue and finance issues for GMA.
So Ryan, revenue and finance is, I don't know how I can overstate this. It's a pretty complex set of laws and issues and the things you're dealing with. And so, you know, this article talking about suggesting that states offer more flexibility, we've talked with Larry Hansen about, you know, the importance of home rule and grateful that we have it to a great extent in Georgia. But what were your overall thoughts about the article where we're kind of, that's our topic for today.
Okay. Yeah, definitely a timely issue and one it's nice to see you shed some light on a little bit because we do talk about home rule all the time. And with the pandemic, putting a spotlight on this specific issue on it, I guess one of my main takeaways was we're fortunate in Georgia that a lot of these things that were highlighted in the article were not placed in law here. We've had some really good economic times, and you can see in some of these states that they put things into law in the good times and they came back to haunt them in the bad times and restricted, kind of tied the hands of local governments, especially in one of the few areas that local governments do have flexibility in their ability to collect and revenue and fund their budgets is through property tax. And it seemed like other states really went after that and restricted the ability of local governments. And when these poor economic times came around, it was tough to see them scrambling and attempting to undo the ill-advised moves of the past.
I'm curious, and you can insert your opinion, or you can kind of talk about the conversations you've been around, because like I said, you were in the Senate Research Office before you came to GMA. So you've got plenty of experience on the Capitol and been around some of those conversations and debates and hearings. I noticed in the article, it seemed like, and it seems like a lot of times, even outside of revenue finance, there's kind of this one-size-fits-all approach. Because if you're doing a state law,
absolutely,
that's going to be the same across the state. But we saw in the article, I think it was in Colorado, was the one that sticks out the most, something got passed that was disproportionately negatively affecting rural areas because they said, oh, we're going to do this about home new construction or home prices and everything across the entire state. So I guess just talk about, I don't know what we can do about that. It seems like we need to have things more directed. But as a guy in a small town in rural South Georgia, I'm seeing this all the time. Whether that's kind of the unfunded mandates or some of those things that come down, we say, oh, there's something wrong we need to fix in this insert name of metro county here. and then it makes me do something that was unnecessary. Right. So I don't know how we fix that, but what's, I don't know, some of the conversations you're a part of.
Well, of course, we can't say enough bad things about the one-size-fits-all approach, and I think that isn't limited to revenue and finance by any means. No. But you see it all the time that a legislator hears a complaint from their area, yes, and comes with the broad brush solution for everywhere. And of course, there are instances where that specific issue is indicative of an issue going on everywhere. But other times, we have to over and over again say, well, we can try to figure this out at the local level. We can try to fix these issues there without having to put something into state law that's going to impact all of Georgia. And again, specifically revenue and finance, of course, no one likes taxes, right? We all,
right.
They're a necessary part. And so you'll get the complaint, especially, mentioning the property taxes that came up a lot within the article, is that the specific problem will be brought to the legislature of their area. And it's oftentimes it is property tax, and it's a complex thing, but that the property tax is different how it's thought of across the state. We've seen the suggestions and in the past of some of these broad changes to property tax based on some complaints from specific areas, and level heads have usually prevailed in these conversations, though, fortunately.
Yeah. One thing just sticks out, and it has to do with revenue, but it's not a revenue thing, I guess. The way the rollback provision works, and you may want to give a summary of that as we talk about this, but if we're leaving our tax rate exactly the same, the millage rate is going to be set exactly the same as it has been the previous year, and you know, sometimes it's the same for multiple years back, but the tax digest has increased because of assessments. Mm-hmm. We have to have, instead of having one hearing, if we're leaving it the same, we have to have three, and we have to put something in the paper with specific language that ends up convincing people we're raising taxes. So
it was interesting to see the taxpayer bill of rights mentioned in a number of states. It looked like it was a trend because we did put ours back in the late 90s into Georgia. And one of the provisions, like you said, is the advertisement of a raise in property taxes. Your taxes are being raised. You have to send out that notice where it's not overly accurate of what is actually going on.
Well, if everyone's got the same assessment and you have the same tax rate, they're going to pay to the penny what they paid the previous year. I don't consider that a tax increase.
And you see it raised across the digest. And this, even if the millage rate is not being rolled back and you're seeing an increase in assessment rates, that doesn't tell you anything about your specific property either.
Right, exactly.
You see that. And it's worrisome. And that is something that GMA is supporting, is that we have pushed over the last couple of years. House Bill 75 was introduced last year. We're hopeful about it pushing forward this year, is to try to change that to just be more accurate, be more transparent about what is actually going on when you talk about the taxpayer bill of rights rollback.
I would classify that as something that's maybe more pertinent to a fast-growing metropolitan city or county, as opposed to rural South Georgia. At least I'll say rural Georgia generically, not just South Georgia everywhere. So, any other takeaways from the article? And I guess what have been some of the conversations, and maybe you want to refer to some things that have actually happened over the past just few years with regard to increased flexibility, or maybe unfortunately we've kind of gone the other way.
Right. It wouldn't relate to increased flexibility. One of the things suggesting in the back is, in the back of the article, was to look at the flexibility, and I tie that hand in hand with efficient collection of taxes. And we've done a few efforts supported by GMA. The legislature has passed a few things in recent years looking at modernizing the tax code to adjust to the different ways people are now spending money. It was only several years back, the United States Supreme Court passed a wafer decision, which, without getting too technical into allowed for the collection of internet sales tax. It allowed for a different kind of nexus test. And that has really evolved over the last couple of years to try to encompass all the sales that have gone on over the internet. And this was obviously huge over the last year or so. And I think that's a trend that we're seeing in Georgia. It is a positive trend that is supporting local revenue streams, is just attempting to collect all the tax that's out there. And that's something I think that both parties can support. It's a very,
right.
Yeah.
I think it's been said more than once, the government usually lags behind technology and some of the societal changes.
Absolutely.
Things.
Absolutely. So we're always a couple of years behind.
That's right.
A couple of years behind adjusting legislation to technology. And the more proactive and the more forward thinking you can be about different areas growing in the future, I think this past year, Marketplace Facilitator was passed, right. and attempting to collect the hotel motel tax on Airbnbs and on the Airbnbs, VRBOs, I don't want to specify any one company,
but
they're short-term rental platforms and the platforms that you now book hotels over to make sure that was captured was another move in that direction. But that took probably a few years more than it needed to. I think people were staying in these short-term rentals for years now, and they were not avoiding the tax, but it just the law wasn't crafted for this new technology. And so looking ahead and trying to it's always impossible to predict where the next boom is going to come. But as we start to see these companies pop up and start to see the trends coming our way, being as proactive thinking as possible.
And again, that's a fairness issue. And I'll give an example. I'll pat my own back here. Because of some of the things that happened as far as collecting more of the sales tax, Ocilla just decreased its property tax by $1 million. I think our tax rate was way too high when I came into office, and we're not going to attract industry with a really high property tax rate. So being able to kind of, just like we were talking about before we recorded, diversifying where we're collecting the revenue. It's very focused on property tax, but if we can just, you know, peel that off a little bit and that level playing field certainly helps all that.
Yeah, and we talked about, and property tax is the one area you do have a little flexibility. You can't control the number of sales going on in your, the people coming to your
You can
to
try
city.
To increase them, but
you do the best you can on what you have and just making sure that the legislature and us on the government relations team is trying to support y'all and making sure that the other various funds that you're drawing from are being collected as efficiently as possible. So, yeah.
You want to delve into TAVT? That's been an interesting thing that's gone over. That's a revenue source. I might have to explain that one too.
Oh my gosh. The change to total ad valorem tax from the birthday tax predated my time coming down to the legislature.
Luckily, my time to being the mayor. Yeah.
It's the running joke that we don't get to have a legislative session without dealing with some type of TAVT issue. And we've had some major changes in the last couple of years and small changes. And it's just one of those, it's a work in progress still, of course. But I know that the change to TAVT from the birthday tax has had a negative impact across the state a little bit, and we're still trying to deal with that, and we're still trying to hammer that out and fix the law as best as possible.
And just to make sure everyone listening, if you don't recognize the term TAVT, that's your car tag. That's your taxes you used to pay every year. You still do if your car was purchased before, I think, 2013. Is right. So if you still got a car you purchased before then, you're still paying
your
taxes.
You're paying your birthday tax, yep.
You buy a new car after that, it's all at once, which is higher, and people say, oh my gosh, look at this huge tax bill, but then you don't pay it after that. And it's actually that consistency of revenue has actually affected in a negative way some of our local governments.
Right. And you have different areas across the state, different cities where people just don't buy cars as often.
Right.
And so you're getting that one-time distribution, and it's pretty close to the equivalent amount of a sales tax on the car.
Right.
It's just split up between the state and then the county. And there's a very, very complicated formula put into
city,
state law.
County and school board.
Whether there's an independent school system. And we've had to monkey around with that a little bit.
And that's why you deal with it every single year, right?
Exactly. Monkeying around with it was probably the...
it's not even, that's not so much about the flexibility issue like the article talked about, but certainly that's a great example of how a decision gets made at the state level, and it has all kinds of ripple effects and impacts on local governments in different ways. There are some folks that when you make a change, they say, wait, now we're worse than we were before. We'd go back. And then obviously, if it made a change, it was to benefit somebody somewhere. And we just want to help the majority. But that, once again, that one size fits all means you're going to affect people in different ways.
I've been around politicians, legislators my entire career, and very few decisions are made with bad intentions, right? Everyone makes, puts the law to benefit or their perceived benefit in some way. And obviously it's just going to impact people differently. And that's just one of those that we're going to be dealing with figuring out TAVT for a while.
So. Well, I mean, revenue and finance will never stay stagnant. No, we won't just set it and say, okay, now we've perfected it. It's perfect.
I'd be out of a job if we did. So
I think you got really good job security in this. Well, Ryan, before we go, any insights, any things you're looking at, the discussions that are having that may result in some kind of legislative action or at least proposals in the coming legislative session?
Oh, my gosh.
TAVT, right?
Yeah, I can guarantee there will be some TAVT. Hopefully we're not going to see any changes to property tax. We have some proposals that are out there that we're working with legislators on. As always, we're going to be playing a lot of defense. We're going to be trying to protect home rule. I'm sure Larry talked a good bit about that. But no, we're looking forward to the general session, but we also, in just depending on, I'm not sure when this will air, we have the special session coming up starting November 3rd. And so we'll have eyes on redistricting a little bit. Obviously, that's going to be a huge issue for across the state, one that fortunately we're not overly involved with. But
it'll affect everybody too. Ryan, thanks for talking with us today. And
thanks for having me on. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for advocating for all of Georgia cities.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Well, small towners, that'll do it for this episode of Small Town Podcast. I want to thank Alexandria Zhang, Larry Hansen, and Ryan Bowersox for talking with me today. As always, I want to thank our season sponsors for Season 4 of Small Town Podcast, the Georgia Municipal Association, Consolidated Pipe, and the Douglas Coffee County Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development Authority. Thank you all for supporting us as we explore and share great small towns and sometimes talk about issues that affect us all. I'll talk to you soon, and y'all are welcome to come to Osceola anytime.
Small Town Podcast is an Irwinomics production. We release new episodes every other week featuring small towns through stories of the people who live and lead there. Our podcast episodes are made possible with editing assistance from Resonate Recordings, who also mixes and masters all of our episodes. You can subscribe to Small Town Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, and the next episode will download while you sleep. You can also leave us a rating and review, which would help us reach new listeners. We would really appreciate it. Beyond our episodes, you can engage with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also learn more about us and the small towns we visit by visiting our website, www.smalltownpodcast.com. We'd love to show all you small towners out there some great images from the small towns we visit and let you know about the festivals and events you can participate in. Thanks again for listening, and we hope to see you real soon, because there's no place like Osceola, Georgia.
We stand adjourned.